The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 5 of this 7-day sesshin, the first in 2018 here in January. And to continue sharing and commenting on what Kathleen Dowling Singh has written in her book, Unbinding, The Grace Beyond Self. Beyond self. As you've heard in all the earlier Teishos, we just take this self-image to be fixed, permanent, and who we really are. It's none of those. It's constantly changing. It's not fixed. It is developed as a result of our habit patterns of body, speech, and mind over lifetimes. And the way this is sort of elucidated, or was elucidated by the Buddha, is called dependent origination or dependent arising. And here he maps out exactly how it happens. Modern brain imaging has also shown that, as one of the neuroscientists said, synapses that wire together, I don't think I'm remembering this correctly. At any rate, as we repeat actions, whether they're thoughts or speech or actions, it forms more deeply in our brain. They can actually see this. This is also, there's a old saying, use it or lose it. And that is good news in terms of letting go negative habit patterns, the most fundamental of which is this assumption that the self-image is who we really are. So let's back up just slightly and show what we did yesterday a little bit. This is what Kathleen says. Over time, I've come to see that our experiential realization of these teachings, the teachings of dependent origination, depends upon 3 things. The first has to do with contemplation, clear seeing. Our deep penetration of the workings of these mutually influencing conditions, that is our deep seeing of them and understanding of them and recognizing that they are true, both in our own long-term and momentary experience of life, leads to realization. Although our tendency is to continue to try to find fulfillment within these conditions, and oh boy, don't we. Just a little thought. It's harmless, isn't it? Sitting on the cushion, we've gone deeper and deeper and deeper, and then this little thought pops up, this tempting little thought, this idea. It won't hurt just to turn around and take a look at it, will it? And then we find ourselves way down the trail, having invented all kinds of things around that thought. This makes it most important that we just give ourselves to the practice, that as we are tempted to move off to the side, you know, I've done some decent practice today, what's wrong with, you know, entertaining this little idea or thought? Or some amazing seeming insight appears and we get drawn away into it, and it's not an insight, it's a makyo. This is why determination is one of the 3 pillars of Zen. Commitment, determination, a willingness to do it regardless, because all kinds of things are going to come up. The Buddha's own telling of his awakening experience in under the Bodh tree in Bodh Gaya so many centuries ago, as he sat down, crossed his legs, realized that he wasn't going to find his answers if he continued to do the prevailing spiritual practice of the day, which was ascetic practice, that he was going to have to look inside at his own mind to find the liberation that he longed for deeply. And so he sat down. And of course, in the beginning, things are going rather well. He's able to focus after all that training. And then what happens is, it's personified as Mara, but it really is, that's just one way of explaining it. There's nobody outside us doing this to us. We're doing it to ourselves. First thing that happens is he's tempted by these beautiful images of women dancing, swaying. Come on. And he ignores it. And the next thing that happens is that pain erupts in his body. Knees are screaming, back is yelling at him. Anything but sitting like this, please get up and move around. Abandon this practice. And that doesn't work either. And that's personified by demons hurling boiling mud and lances and spears at him. And then finally, the last attempt to dissuade him. The question of whether he really has what it's got to come to awakening. And he calls upon the earth to witness, is how it's written in the ancient scriptures. He realizes that whether or not, he's going to do it anyway. And we all go through these kinds of things. But if we're truly to become free, we have to stick out the practice because it changes us at the very fundamental physiological level. It changes our brain. And the less we engage in the habit patterns that cause us suffering, the less suffering we'll have. It's pretty simple. The sticky part is that this clinging comes into play, and we kind of want to think about some things, do some things. We don't realize that the consequences are going to be challenging for us. There is that old story of the very wealthy man in a castle. He hears a knock on the door, and he goes to the door and opens it, and there's this absolutely ravishing, beautiful young woman there. And she says, "May I come in?" He says, "Of course, of course, of course, come on in." And then very shortly thereafter, there's another knock on the door. He goes again. This time it's a wretched-looking person, another woman, but she's horrible-looking, horrid-feeling, doesn't want anything to do with this wretch. And she says, "Can I come in?" He says, "No way! Out of here. Get out of here." And she says, "But my sister's in here. And everywhere she goes, I follow. Her name is Happiness. My name is Suffering." And that's kind of how it goes. We have moments of peace, joy, happiness. And then our mind starts calculating things, and maybe we project on some situation, and all of a sudden it turns sour. Because of the habit pattern of delusion, of ignorance, because of dependent origination. She continues. The first has to do with contemplation, clear seeing, our deep penetration of the workings of these mutually influencing conditions, both in our own long-term and momentary experience of life, leads to realization. Although our tendency is to continue to try to find fulfillment within these conditions, in reality, we recognize that we're playing a losing game. The second has to do with self-surrender. Because if we're not willing to let go the habit patterns that bring us pain and suffering, it's going to be an endless cycle. Pleasure here, pain and suffering there. Pleasure here, pain and suffering there. The second has to do with self-surrender, our willingness to let go of our entrapment in an endless cycle that holds no lasting promise of peace or awakening. Surrender involves more than simply the willingness to let go of any thought that's been tugging at us, for example, although it certainly includes that. Surrender has to do with releasing our attachment to an identification with thought, with the mind's wanderings in general, except as conceptuality and mental operations serve a useful, practical, additive function, which is kind of minor compared to what they normally do. Surrender is the emptying of the mind, the emptying of its beliefs and fabrications, especially the fabrication of the I illusion, the me, that I exist, that I'm this way, that people treat me this way. Or we have a whole host of assumptions around it. The third factor upon which our realizations depend is grace. Our realizations deepen with the intensity with which grace arises in us. And you remember that grace is her word for what in Buddhism we would call Buddha nature, or our true nature, what in Christianity and Judaism is called God. And all the different religions have got their name for it. Our realizations depend with the intensity with which grace arises in us and the openness we have to making room for it through self-surrender and the transformational practices of contemplation and meditation. In a nutshell, if we want to be free, and first we have to recognize why and where and how we're caught, or at least that we're caught. And we wouldn't be here if we hadn't recognized some level of that. And if we want to be truly free, we have to bite the bullet and do the practice. And the practice will be most effective if we resist the temptations to distract ourselves from it. And yet, those temptations are strong, and in the early years of practice, that's what we mostly have to deal with, trying to focus the mind. And suddenly we're off in Africa in a balloon ride over the wild animals there or something like that. Or we're madly in love with somebody. Or we're thinking about old hurts. We have to keep drawing the mind back and plunging deep, searching. We don't even know what we're searching for. And that's in part because it's beyond words. We can't possibly know. And even when we realize some aspect of it through Kensho, through Satori, we still can't describe it. We just know that something amazing has happened, and yet it is so ordinary. So the way it's come down to us in our Buddhist practice, a description of all this, which may help to know and to understand, see what's going on in our lives and help us gear up the search for real liberation, true liberation. And Kathleen Dowling Singh says she has her own way of wording these dependent arising as 12 conditions that are dependent upon each other, and the result is either pain and suffering or not, depending on what we do. The first is ignorance. Ignorance in this context is the confused fog that arises from our unwillingness to actually inquire into the truth. It rests on assumptions and mistaken conclusions. It's pretty common to think we know it all, but do we? There are examples of people who have had deep insights, even contemporary people. I think here of Flora Courtois, Jacques Le Seran, and I'm sure there are many others that don't have names that we know. And of course, every morning we chant a lineage, either the Rinzai lineage or the Soto lineage on alternate days, and each one of those people has experienced to such a depth that they have freed themselves and been able to teach countless other people who are not named in those lineage chants. Ignorance in this context is the confused fog that arises from our unwillingness to actually inquire into the truth. It rests on assumptions and mistaken conclusions. The root of ignorance is resistance to seeing things as they are, a willingness to ignore. We cling to our ideas about ourselves. We hug them tight to our chest, and they become our self-image. Nobody loves me. I'm a failure. Or our current example in the White House, I'm a genius and brilliant. We all have a very complex set of assumptions around ourselves. And yet at some level, it's not quite as solid as we would like to think it is. Here and there are holes in it. And that's probably why we're sitting here in the Zendo, because we're not 100% convinced that this self-image that we assume we are is actually real. And that's a vital start. The root of ignorance is resistance to seeing things as they are, a willingness to ignore. Living within the condition of ignorance could be compared to following a compass that, unbeknownst to us, because we haven't bothered to check, stubbornly avoids pointing to true north. And the next thing is karmic formations. This refers to the condition of habit, deeply ingrained. Thoughts and other conditioned reactivities pass over these karmic formations and are conditioned by them, in much the same way as ocean currents are conditioned by the topography of mountains and valleys on the ocean floor, conditioned even by rippled patterns in the sand. Here are our stories, our assumptions, our desires, our beliefs, our narrative consistent memories. They give shape to momentary arisings. Next, because of that, is consciousness. Consciousness is a sense-making function, the cohering function. It is an inactive function. It fills in the gaps and inconsistencies that ignorance prefers to ignore and often views as chaotic and or threatening. Intent upon weaving a seamless narrative, the condition of consciousness jumps over careful contemplation, jumps to quick conclusions. It can be recognized in our aversion to chaos, our passion for instant gratification, which certainly is mammoth these days, and our constant need to feel we've established terra firma, no matter how illusory. Next comes name and form. This refers to the condition that labels and brings into form via labeling. These are our fabrications. Based on the memories of karmic formations, name and form functions to pull appearances out of potentiality and into the foreground of attention. This condition functions to form both the egoic self and the world we experience within self-reference. And that's an interesting thing. We see the world through the lens of our assumptions, through the lens of our self-image. And we see it the way that fits with the self-image. And as we go deeper in our practice, we begin to see the world more clearly and differently. And we find that our interactions with people change because we're not coming so strongly through the self-image filter. Continue it. And we will become able to flow effortlessly, seamlessly, ethically, compassionately, wisely in response to whatever comes up. This is what our practice offers. Next is the six senses, sometimes called sensory apparatus, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. We don't normally think of the mind as a sense, but it is, because it judges and defines what the senses produce. It's the condition that allows the form to be seen, sound to be heard, odor to be smelled, taste to be tasted, touch to be felt, and thoughts to be registered. This condition is the equipment of manifesting in human form, eyes, ears, nose, mouth, the sensory capacity of the body, and the capacity of conceptual mind. Contact is the condition that arises when form is seen, sound is heard, odor is smelled, tasted, touch felt, and thoughts registered. It is the moment of connection between that which apprehends and the object of apprehension. And Bodhidharma has said, don't give rise to secondary thoughts. Clear, bare naked perception. But we don't stop there. We judge it. We filter it. A major example of that is this, what's sometimes considered a game called telephone. And I remember in my first year psychology course in university, we did this. The professor whispered in the ear of the first person in the front row something, some statement, and that person then reported it whispering to the person next to them, and so on down the line until it reached the last person in the class. And then the last person stood up and reported what they had been told, and the professor who had it written down read what he had reported to the first person, and it was vastly different because each person had interpreted, had heard, not the words, but their own filtering of the words. And this is why we have so many challenges in communication and so many challenges in our lives. Because we filter according to our assumptions. And the biggest assumption, of course, is that self-image. Can you see now how suffering can result? Craving is a condition. Oops, we skipped over feeling. Feeling is the condition of reaction to contact, itself conditioned by the other conditions. Feeling upon contact arises automatically as either positive, negative, or neutral. The latter feeling, neutral, is sometimes referred to as neither positive nor negative. Every single moment of contact has an accompanying feeling. We jump to judge. Craving is a condition that arises with a personalization of feeling. There's an ingrained inclination, a psychic orientation to act upon or lean into, with a slight sense of identification or ownership, whatever feeling arises. And next comes grasping, because grasping is a consequence of craving, unless we don't go forward beyond the craving. And that is an option. Anybody who's tried to stop any kind of habit pattern, whether it's smoking, drinking, eating, overeating, it doesn't matter what it is, knows that it's really, really difficult to resist that craving and not go into action. Grasping is a condition of irresistible desire. It functions as a compulsive urge operating within the interplay of the other conditions of dependent origination. Doesn't matter if it's the urge to slam on the brake as a truck is about to crash into us, or the urge to scratch an itch on our cheek, or the urge to shoot up another dose of heroin, or any of the other urges. An urge to lash out at somebody, an urge to hug somebody. Regardless of what the urge is for, it is held as necessary for survival. It operates, although this is not necessarily articulated, as if whatever the urge is about is a life or death issue. The urge to grasp arises and attention blindly follows. Becoming is the condition that defines the blind follower of the grasping. This is the condition that gives rise to the need to be the self slamming on the brakes, the need to be the self scratching the itch. Becoming refers to our hunger for existence, our desire to maintain an ego, our thirst for a sense of being, somebody. And we can see this again at the top of our chain of command here in the United States these days. An urge to be noticed, an urge to have people recognize us. This goes for anybody, really. An urge to be recognized as somebody special, an urge to be recognized as somebody lovable, somebody worthy, somebody this or that or the other. Name it, the list is very long. But what's the truth? Is that who we really are? Dive into the practice. Search beyond all of this conditioning. Don't give in to the urges. Don't give in to the judgments. Okay, the judgments come. Okay, the urges come. You don't have to operate on them. Commit to deeply realizing who you are beyond all of that, because that's all a paper doll. Who are we really? We're not this persona. We're not this self-image. And if we're not that, who are we? Birth is the apparent rising of the blind follower. It arises in dependence upon becoming's need to be the blind follower. Birth is the outcome of the issues preceding and mutually conditioning. It is the birth of the experience of a temporary satiation and a self, that's in quotes, the experience of the satiation. And then finally, aging and death is the condition birth gives rise to. Whether this occurs in the perceived time span of the physical body or in the flash of a momentary spin of the cycle of the mutually influential conditions of dependent arising. So, that's how it all comes about. If you want a little bit more information from a slightly different way of saying it, there is an excellent, although a rather lengthy, commentary on BuddhaNet. If you Google dependent origination, it'll show up. And I'll share just a little bit of that. This is one interpretation of the relation between the 12 components of dependent origination. And it divides the 12 components into three groups. And these are defilements, which are traditionally called klesha, greed, anger, and delusion, actions, karma, and sufferings, which is dukkha. Ignorance, craving, and clinging belong to the group of defilements. Mental formation and becoming belong to the group of actions. Remaining seven, that is consciousness, name and form, the six senses, contact, feeling, birth and old age and death, belong to the group of sufferings. You may recall that in the context of the Four Noble Truths, we have said that ignorance, desire, and ill will are the causes of suffering. If we look here at the three components of dependent origination that are included in the group of defilements, we will find ignorance, craving, and clinging. Here, too, ignorance is the most basic. It is because of ignorance that we crave for pleasures of the senses, for existence and for non-existence. And the Buddha has said, we suffer because we want things to be a certain way when they can't be or aren't. We don't want things to be a certain way when they are. We want people to be there for us when they can't be or aren't. We don't want people to be there when they are. And on it goes. The two components of dependent origination that are included in the group of actions and mental formation and becoming, in the groups, are mental formation and becoming. Mental formation refers to the impressions of habits that we have formed in our stream of conscious moments, our conscious continuum. These impressions or habits are formed by repeated actions. It's just like the instructions for stopping smoking or any other habit pattern. In the case of things that lead us to suffering, aside from those, the instruction is to resist the temptation to indulge. And here we have the advantage of an alternative action, which is to seek deeply what lies beneath that urge, to find the truth. And as it says in the Bible, and the truth shall set you free. So fundamentally, the more we can dive deep beyond all the temptations to entertain ourselves along the way, some of which are no doubt going to feel entirely legitimate, the deeper we can dive in an ongoing manner, the more we will change the habit patterns, weaken the habit patterns of craving, of greed, anger, and ignorance, and all the rest, the whole chain of causation. This is it in a nutshell. The rest is up to each one of us. How much do we want to be free? What are we willing to do in order to get there? I leave you with that thought. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. Thank you very much for listening.